This is Yaron Brook, guest speaking on Dr. Leonard Peikoff's podcast. I'm here to apply Ayn Rand's philosophy of objectivism to your real-life questions. Your real-life questions specifically to current events, including politics, economics, and foreign policy. My answers are posted every other week on Mondays. Leonard will continue to answer questions, but now only on alternate Mondays. You can listen to full episodes on iTunes or listen to single questions or full episodes at www.peikoff.com. If you have a question to ask me, simply go to peikoff.com/questions. All right, this is a question about the future. So do you think it's possible in the future work is so well planned and automated that very few humans are needed to run a profitable business? Suppose that's the case, wouldn't it be necessary to redistribute profit in order to allow people who couldn't get one of the rare jobs to survive? No, I don't think such a world is possible. There's always going to be jobs. So what about these people who are not getting these rare jobs? I mean, why can't they go and become farmers and grow their own food? Why can't they start a business that supplies something to other people like them who don't have a job in this newly industrialized thing? Or is the assumption that all food and everything is provided by machines? But there's always something else that can be done. There's always something else to be created. There's always an additional human need that can be created and then satisfied. I think our needs are endless. I don't think there's a possibility that we will ever attain a level where there's nothing new to be invented. There's no new professions to be engaged in. There's no need to be fulfilled. And there are no jobs for people. Now, maybe we won't have to work that long. Maybe we'll only work, I don't know, 10 hours a week or something. But there's no question that people would have jobs and have the ability and have a source of income. And I can't imagine how you would construct a world in which that was not the case, that there was rare jobs. I mean, how would you sell your product that other people weren't producing something that you would trade with? Think of all business. Think of all businesses fundamentally trade. Well, you need other people to trade with. And if there's 7 billion people trading, that's better than if there are 100 people trading. And for 7 billion people to trade, 7 billion people would have to work. And I can't imagine a world, you know, you'd have to be a science fiction writer to recreate the metaphysics of the world, to imagine a situation where those 7 billion people couldn't find something productive, some service, some productive purpose to have that wouldn't facilitate the ability to trade with the other 7 billion people. Okay. I think this is the Luddite question that we keep getting every time new technology comes about, which is, won't the technology displace all jobs and robots run everything? I mean, this has been going on forever. This question has been going on since the late part of the 18th century. It's still around today, and it's just false. There's no evidence to suggest this is the case, and I can't even create the imaginary scenario where this is the case, as long as people are free. Freedom is what creates jobs. And as long as people are free, there will be jobs for everybody in the sense that you could always be self-employed. Okay, this question is about a restaurateur has the right to discriminate against people he doesn't like, rational or irrational. But then he says, but given that he needs a business license to operate and he might fall under corporate law if he goes big enough, doesn't the state expressing the will of the people have justification and mandate that he not discriminate? No, no, no. First of all, the state doesn't express the will of the people because there is no such thing as the will of the people. There's only the will of individuals. There's the expression of the majority of the people, but the majority of the people have no right to violate the rights of the minority. So there is no such thing as the will of the people. That is collectivistic terminology if ever there was one. So only individuals exist. Only individuals will. Only individuals have values. And only individuals would dictate what happens to the restaurateur if he does something irrational. I wouldn't go and work. I wouldn't go and eat at that restaurant. I would boycott it. But he has a right to be irrational. The fact that he needs a business license, first of all, in a laissez-faire capitalist economy, it's questionable whether he would need a business license. Why would you need a business license? For what reason does the government have to monitor the fact that you're opening a business? It's none of the government's business. So that's out. Corporate law, sure, but he would have to, you know, under laissez-faire capitalism, if you wanted, you'd pay a fee in order to be under the corporate legal umbrella so that you could benefit from the corporate law standards. But that would be it. That's not, the state has no claim against you because of that. It's there to arbitrate disputes and to make efficient the use of an objective legal system. It's to provide objective law. And that has nothing to do with expressing the will of the people. And again, the state has no right to tell you what you can or cannot do on your property unless you're clearly violating somebody else's rights by harming them physically. Not allowing people access to your property is not harming them. What is my view about how the U.S. handled the situation of American citizens stranded in Yemen? Is there any case where the U.S. government should not rescue its citizens? So I'm going to take the second part of this question because I'm not sure exactly how the U.S. handled the situation of American citizens stranded in Yemen. Now, in Yemen, the United States had an embassy. It had ongoing diplomatic relations. It did not tell its citizens not to go to Yemen because it was actually there. The U.S. had a presence there. And therefore, it's under obligation when the situation changes to rescue all the citizens it has in that country. So if you have diplomatic relations and you have not warned your citizens not to go to a particular country, you are obliged, as part of your responsibility of protecting your citizens' rights, to facilitate their extradition from that country, to get them out, to rescue them, if you will. However, if you say, we have no diplomatic relations with Yemen, Yemen is a dangerous country, the United States government is not responsible for anybody who goes to Yemen. If you go to Yemen, you're on your own. It's at your own risk. In that case, if you've said that explicitly in advance, and I think you should for many countries in the world, for example, North Korea, even today, we have no diplomatic relations. We should have an explicit statement by the State Department that says, if you're an American citizen and you go to North Korea, it's on you. We will not help you, we'll not support you, and we will not rescue you. It's your responsibility. And then you should not rescue the citizens if they still go there in spite of the warning. Okay, would a one-world government be possible and or desired? No, it would not be possible or desired. I think it's impractical. If you think about the responsibility of a government, it's to protect individual rights, which means police and military and a judicial system. I think there's too much of particularly the policing function, which is local, which requires local knowledge, which requires a local presence. And in addition, I just don't think it's a good idea, even if we lived in a world where everybody supported reason, individual rights, and a constitutionally limited government. I think we would want competition. That is, we would want different governments in different geographic areas so that, A, if one of them went rotten, we could escape. B, there's some questions that relate to property rights, that relate to certain complexities around property rights and other issues, where there could be disagreements, legitimate disagreements between governments. And it wouldn't hurt to see how it plays out. That is to see one country doing it one way and another country doing it another way. I mean, this is the idea behind federalism. The idea behind federalism is not, as some libertarians would suggest, every state do whatever the hell they want and the federal government has no role to play. No, within the context of individual rights, or protecting individual rights, which is the sole responsibility of the federal government, different states can experiment with doing it a little differently. But that does not excuse some states from having slavery, because slavery is clearly a violation of individual rights, and therefore it's the moral responsibility, the legal responsibility of the federal government to end slavery in those states. So as long as it's in the scope of what is reasonable to disagree about when it comes to individual rights, different states can experiment and see what works and what doesn't. And this is true of multiple governments within the world. It would be beneficial to have several. How many? I don't know. I think you just need that to evolve. I think probably fewer than we have today, but obviously significantly more than one. So this is a question about Brazil. What do I make of the pro-capitalist populist movement gathering steam in Brazil? I don't think it's pro-capitalist. I think it's populist, and it's generally opposed to the cronyism that dominates the Brazilian economy and the corruption that dominates the Brazilian economy and the Brazilian political system. So in that sense, it's a movement towards a freer market. And so I am very positive about it in the sense that it's anti-corruption, anti-cronyism. And by doing that, there is the possibility that it will become more capitalist if it overthrows the current government and elects somebody who's more pro-markets. But whether they will actually go from anti-cronyism anti-corruption to pro-capitalism, that is yet to be seen. Now, the question goes on, is this ARI's influence? I doubt that. I mean, there might be at the margin influence of Ayn Rand. Ayn Rand's been translated into Portuguese in Brazil for many years. There are a number of pro-free market organizations in Brazil that have been influenced by Ayn Rand and to some extent by ARI. But whether they dominate this movement, this anti-cronyism movement in Brazil, I just don't know. I think they're probably having some influence at the margin. I think if there's hope for Brazil to turn to pro-capitalism versus just anti-cronyism, it'll be because of the influence of groups like this, free market groups like this, who have been influenced by Ayn Rand. So long term, they might be an influence to Ayn Rand's ideas. Okay, so there's a question about North Korea. Is North Korea the only true communist country left in the world? Does that give some hope the capitalist ideology is being dominant to some extent? North Korea is probably the only consistent, as close as you can be to consistently communist. Of course, you cannot be consistently communist because then everybody dies. So this is why the communists always complained that oh, they didn't apply it right. Well, you can't apply it right because it's so antagonistic to human nature that everybody's going to die if you apply it anywhere close to right. So you have to not apply it right just for it to survive. And that's what's going on in North Korea. You know, Cuba is still quite communist. There are elements of communism in other countries. But yeah, I think North Korea is the most consistent. Now, does that mean that the rest of the world has moved away from communism? Yeah, I mean, that's a good sign. So there's definitely hope. There's definitely positives for hundreds of millions of people, if not billions of people, because of the collapse of communism in the Soviet Union, the collapse of communism in China, in Vietnam, and in many, many other places. But that doesn't mean that it's been replaced by capitalist ideology. What it's been replaced with are markets driven by some kind of pragmatic view of the economy. That is, if we allow some markets, wealth is created, which is true. We allow some freedom, wealth is created, and that's all true. So let's allow for that, but not allow for full capitalism. So, I mean, it's a wonderful phenomena, the collapse of communism. It's a wonderful phenomena that so many countries have adopted elements of market economics and freer political systems all over the world. That has freed up billions of people and has increased the wealth of hundreds and hundreds of millions of people. 800 million people have come out of poverty in the last 30 years because of this movement away from communism towards greater markets. Unfortunately, that does not guarantee our success, and that does not an indication that capitalism as an ideology, as a philosophical belief system, as an ideal is on the rise. I think what we have today in the world is a lot of pragmatism. And of course, people don't learn from the collapse of capitalism. You know, they say things like, yeah, communism collapsed, but yeah, capitalism has its problems too. Look at the financial crisis and so on. So we've still got a long, long way to educate people about the benefits of capitalism and why capitalism is the unknown ideal.
If you want to know more about Ayn Rand's philosophy, I invite you to ask me a question. I can't answer them all, but I do read them all. Just write to leonard@peakoff.com. And if you haven't already done so, start by reading Ayn Rand's two most important novels, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. And I might add that it wouldn't hurt you to read my latest book, The Dim Hypothesis.